I continued my training, my meditation and my work, evolved it, and then began teaching it to Navy SEALs. And that became the basis for SEALFIT, where I integrated all the mental training that I had developed and tested and then simplified, and then combining it with rigorous integrated physical training program. With SEALFIT, I began to really develop this methodology that I call Unbeatable Mind. And that's become the foundation for my work. Running a SEAL team is like running a business, except, you know, you don't have to worry about making money. You're just worried about, you know, making sure your team is ready for combat. Yeah, you got to be tough physically and mentally. You know, you got to be able to run, swim, and do countless push-ups and pull-ups. But none of that matters if you're all about yourself.
Welcome to the Thought Leader Revolution with Nikki Ballou. Join the revolution. There's never been a better time in history to speak your truth, find your freedom, and make your fortune. Each week, we interview the world's top thought leaders and learn the secrets of how they built a 6 to 7 figure practice. This episode has been brought to you by eCircleAcademy.com, the proven system to add 6 to 7 figures a year to your thought leader practice.
Welcome to the Thought Leader Revolution Podcast. I'm your host, Nikki Ballou. And boy, do we have an exciting guest lined up for you today. Today's guest is a return guest, although the last time he was here was several years ago. He is a retired Navy SEAL. He is a best-selling author, and he's the founder of SEALFIT. I am speaking, of course, of none other than the one, the only, Mark Divine. Welcome to the show, Mark.
Nick, you get a top rating for that intro. I love your energy.
Appreciate it, brother. Fantastic. Appreciate it.
Thanks for having me here. Nice.
Good to have you back. I'm glad Mike Osterlink reconnected us. I enjoyed the conversation we had several years ago, and I'm glad to have you back. So let me just give you a refresher on the show. The Thought Leader Revolution Podcast is a show that showcases some of the top thinkers and innovators in various fields. And our audience are mostly entrepreneurs. These are the men and women who start businesses, go out there and look for ways to make their dreams come alive. And the reason they listen to the show is not because of me. I'm here every week. They listen because of you. They want to learn from you. They want to take the best that you have to give them and start to think about how to implement it in their own lives. But before they do that, they need to get to know you a little bit. Longtime listeners will remember who you are, but we've got a whole bunch of new listeners. So tell us your backstory. How'd you get to be the great Mark Divine?
I was born at a very young age in a small town in upstate New York. I'm from upstate New York. I went to a nice liberal arts college in upstate New York called Colgate University. That took me down to Manhattan, where I launched my first career as a CPA working for Coopers & Lybrand, now PricewaterhouseCoopers. They sent me to NYU to ostensibly get my MBA in finance via a master's in accounting. So I was off to the races. And that fit the story that I grew up with. My family was a business family, had a manufacturing company that had been around since like 1790-something. You know, they navigated that through both world wars and the depression and whatnot. And of course, you know, all the males in the family would go and run run the business. And so that's what I was being groomed for. That was the story. I bought it hook, line, and sinker. When I was in Manhattan, because I was probably a yogi in a past lifetime, and I was a competitive athlete. I decided, or there was this notion in my head that I was not going to look like one of those pasty suits. Right, I was going to maintain my athleticism. I was a lifetime athlete. And this is 1985, before anyone even probably uttered those words. And so I set upon a pretty rigorous regimen of training while I was also working full-time for Coopers and then going to night school at NYU. I would run in the morning, 6 miles, come back, stretch, do a little thought work. At lunchtime, when all my peers were going out and eating a hard carb lunch, I would go to the gym and, you know, like pee on a bunch of equipment and, you know, basically saying stay away and then bang out what I now know is a high intensity interval workout, you know, get it all done in 45 minutes, head back to the office. And then, because school back then, night school with Stern School of Business was down at the old World Trade Center, started at 7:30. Coopers would let us off at around 5 because it was part of this whole, you know, it was part of the program. Coopers was sponsoring me to get my my master's. So I had 2.5 hours, and other peers who were in the program with me, you know, they would go home and, you know, change and eat dinner and maybe prep for class. And yours truly looked at that as an opportunity for training, more training. And so I'm wondering what to do. I stumbled upon a martial arts studio and I started studying a martial art, traditional karate. And it just so happens that the founder of the school, who was the my teacher, Grandmaster Nakamura, was also a Zen teacher. And so I took to that like white on rice. So at 21, I started practicing Zen. And it was, you know, a little bit before and after each class, because, you know, you would bow in and sit quietly and then bow out and sit quietly. But then on Thursday nights, he had a full-on Zen class with a small group of black belts. And I asked if I could join that. He said, yeah, no problem. So there I was, you know, a newly minted white belt sitting with about 12 other black belts, you know, for hour-long sessions or sits. And afterwards, Mr. Nakamura would give us like a little Zen Dharma talk. It was just phenomenal. Absolutely loved it. And I started to feel, you know, like really, I guess, peaceful. I felt different after these things. So I decided to take it up on a daily basis. And I remember that came after one of our little Zen talks where he kind of hammered at home that meditation is really not, it's a daily thing. It's a daily practice. You know, and doing it once a week is nice, but the real transformation comes from it being a daily practice. So I bought myself a little wooden bench and I started meditating every morning after my morning runs for about 20 minutes to 30 minutes, sometimes longer. Well, I tell you what, so this is really the inflection point, because here I am. Now we know about neuroplasticity and, you know, the development of human brains. And, you know, when you're that young, there's still a lot going on upstairs. And there's always a lot going on upstairs. Now it used to be the story that your brain's fully developed by the time you're 25, 26 as a guy. Well, that's not true anymore, but there's a lot going on. And so imagine adding disciplined meditation to a 21-year-old brain that's also jamming a master's degree and full-time work and, you know, all that healthy living. And I started to experience some pretty radical alterations or transformations of consciousness. Began to really clearly see that I had been living this story, that my childhood conditioning had led, you know, the initial layers of me were just like, okay, the story of me being a merchant, being in business, making a lot of money, that was all planted. That was all, you know, that was all conditioning of my family and also culture. And I began to feel a growing disconnect with this path that I had chosen. And so it led me to ask some different questions for the first time in my life. Like, if not that, then what? Who am I? Why am I on this planet? And what am I doing? What am I going to do about it? Am I just going to follow the drumbeat of that story that everyone else is following? Or am I going to really discover who I truly am and why I'm here? And so I started to ask those questions. And that's when I learned, you know, the power of questions, right? The power to ask good questions will determine the quality of your life. And so I started to ask good questions. And I would ask them before I would go into meditation. And I would journal about them afterwards. And it led me to this growing sense or this epiphany, ultimately, that I was meant to be a warrior, that I was a warrior. And so then I had to decide, okay, how am I supposed to be a warrior? And when I started to ask that question, my future was revealed to me. And it was revealed to me, Nikki, in the form of a poster. And I was walking home one night, probably to the dojo or from the dojo, and I had wandered past a Navy recruiting office quite by accident. And I just stopped because a poster kind of facing out toward the road caught my attention. And the poster had the words "Be Someone Special" written across the top. And it had basically Navy SEALs doing cool shit on it. And I had heard of the SEALs, but I certainly wasn't like one of those guys like nowadays where, you know, they've been watching SEALs on TV since they were 12 and they wanted to be a Navy SEAL for that long. This is 1986 by now, or 1987. There really wasn't any information about them. It's a completely secretive organization. But here was this poster. And I looked at it. It didn't say SEALs. It just said U.S. Navy. But I knew that was it. So fast forward, in November of 1989, I got my MBA. I got my CPA, Certified Public Accountancy Certificate in New York State. I passed my first degree black belt test, and then I walked away from it all. And I had gotten accepted to the Navy to go to Oscar Canada School. And then I had orders to following that to basic underwater demolition SEAL training, class 170. And so I left it all behind, became a Navy SEAL. And I graduated number one in my class. 185 hardcore studs show up on day one, and 19 of us graduated. And I was standing there as number one graduate, and my entire small team, what we call boat crew, who I had trained with every day, had graduated with me. And I attribute all of that to Nakamura's training and the meditation. So it, clearly that period of from 21 to 25 in New York on the meditation bench under a Grand Master's, you know, watchful eye, had completely radically changed who I am, my sense of self, and not just that, but my entire trajectory in life. Because I didn't grow up with anything about the military and my future until that was all revealed to me. So that's kind of like the backstory. I was so kind of profoundly moved by that experience. And then, of course, I continued my training, my meditation and my work, evolved it, and then began teaching it to Navy SEALs. And that became the basis for SEAL Fit, where I integrated all the mental training that I had developed and tested and then simplified, first on myself and then teaching my teammates, and then combining it with kind of a rigorous integrated physical training program, and launched SEAL Fit in 2006 after I'd gotten off active duty. I was still in the reserves, but I was off active duty so I could get, you know, into the business world. But I came into the business world as an entrepreneur this time. And so with SEAL Fit, I began to really develop this methodology that I call Unveil Mind. And that's become the foundation for my work. And I've got a book by that name, Unveil Mind, which is my self-published bestseller. And I've got a couple other bestsellers that are, you know, look at various angles of how to, you know, forge elite level thinking, leading, awareness, you know, really an integrated approach to, you know, holistically develop into a whole mind. You know, it's a very much of integration of East and West. I teach practices that are, you know, wouldn't be unfamiliar to someone who is steeped in, you know, ancient yoga traditions or, you know, Tibetan Buddhism, but are completely, you know, unobtainable to the average, you know, Western guy in general. You know, I don't have all male clients, but most of them are because of the physical nature of my background and experience in SEAL Fit. So that's probably a long-winded answer to who I am, but it's an interesting story for sure. Sometimes I wonder how I got here myself.
It's a great answer. It's a very comprehensive answer. Let's dig into some of the aspects and elements of your story. I mean, you had 181 people start the SEAL training with you and only 19 graduated. That's just a hair over 10%. That is absolutely incredible. And my understanding is that's par for the course with SEAL programs. Is that correct?
For sure. Yeah, definitely. I mean, there have been zero graduation classes, meaning when nobody graduated. And then there have been some where maybe the grad rate was up around 15%, but on average, it's 10 to 15%, somewhere in there. And that's the interesting thing about that, Stetney, is the people who show up are highly qualified. It's not like you take 185 people off the street, you know, in 19. Now, these are, it's most like me spent years preparing. You know, it took me almost 18 months to get selected for the SEALs as an officer, right? It would have been quicker had I gone enlisted, but even then, you know, it takes a lot of the folks I train, it takes several years to prepare physically and to pass all the wickets and get all the waivers and whatnot. You know, when I was built, my body was built on a foundation of endurance sports. And so I was a competitive swimmer and rower in college, and I was a triathlete. So I had a lot of that going on for me. But you layer on top of that all the martial arts training, which is pure functional fitness and the humility that comes from, you know, losing at least half your fights. And then layer on top of that all the meditation. And I was a good candidate, let's just say. Like I said in my intro, what really made the difference between me and the other people was the meditation, was the mental control that I had, the emotional control, the awareness, the non-reactivity, the sensitivity to be able to take care of my teammates' needs and to really kind of feel into what they were dealing with before maybe they even were aware of it. So there's the benefits of having that kind of practice at a young age were extraordinary for me for a warrior, right? It made me like much more aware as a warrior. I was able to navigate my entire career literally without injury and even wow. combat. Yeah, I mean, that's insane. I went to the VA to see if I had any rating, and they kind of laughed me out of there. I'm like, it's like you don't have anything in your record. You know, you're wow. like perfectly healthy. And I said, yeah. And I attribute that to the awareness and the, you know, the proprioception, body awareness that accrues from the combination of a integrated movement practice like karate, and I took up yoga later on, as well as the both internal and external awareness that accrues through a practice of meditation. By the way, these skills are the frontier for leadership development, which is really where I've turned my attention in the last, you know, 4 or 5 years. And I'm finishing up my PhD at Pepperdine in global leadership and change. And because I believe, and I want to bring these skills into the world of leadership development, because I believe they are the next frontier. Like, how are we going to navigate the VUCA of AI and crazy, you know, chaos that's happening with the politics of the world and the violence? Well, it's not going to be by doing the same thing we did in the past and hoping for different results. It's by doing something radically different. And that is to develop our minds so that we tap into more awareness, more potential, more clarity, more spontaneous creativity, those types of things. And those are all part of our makeup. It's just that we haven't developed them in the West. We kind of let those skills atrophy.
You're right about that. I'm very fascinated by the fact that you went throughout your career without a major injury. I mean, I'm 56 yeah. years old myself. Last year, I went on a journey of remaking my fitness and my body. I hired a
good for you
bodybuilder coach. Nice. And I lost 58 pounds. I got into really good shape, and I decided to do a competition. And he's been teaching me how to train the way a bodybuilder from the 70s by the name of Mike Mentzer used to train, which is heavy duty training, really intense, going beyond failure. And I've got a bunch of injuries right now that I'm dealing with as part of the process of getting ready for this competition. And I got to tell you, I'm fascinated. I really like to understand how this can potentially help someone like me overcome these injuries more quickly, because they're not fun. I'll tell you that right now. And it makes good sense. I've done meditation in the past, but I've been sporadic with it. And I think maybe it's time that I not be. But if you wouldn't mind sharing some of your thoughts on that for me, I'd really appreciate it.
Sure, of course. Well, this is all stream of consciousness, so I have no idea where it's going to go. But we've got to start with kind of at a meta level, right? You've certainly heard of the concept of yin and yang. Everyone has. Yep. Yin and yang, simply, there's a lot of ways to look at it. One is action and non-action, or action and receptivity. It's the masculine and the feminine principle. It's the power versus force, right? Yang is, you know, I'm putting power into the world. I'm pushing. I'm meeting resistance, and I'm getting shit done. Whereas the yin is power, and power comes from within, right? It's going within, and it's developing clarity. Power comes from clarity. It's developing an intuitive sense of, what's around the corner, so to speak. And so that's, you know, very important for recovery and for injury prevention. In the yoga tradition, yin and yang is described as sthira sukha, or effort and surrender. Yang being effort and yin being surrender. All of these aspects or principles of this concept of the duality between hard and soft, masculine, feminine, yin, yang, effort, surrender, are need to be brought into our training. And I learned that through my time with Nakamura, because the yang of karate was the hardcore, you know, fighting, kicking, punching. You're starting to get a little bit of yin energy with the katas, right? Or what some people call the dances, the forms. But that's still pretty young. It's hard, but there's more of a soft internal kind of awareness, right? It's more like moving meditation. But then the real yin came in sitting on that meditation bench. That's just pure receptivity where you're not pushing up, you're not putting energy into the world. Think about it this way. Yang is you push, and because we know the world is it's entropy, it'll push back. Whereas yin is I receive. There's no pushing. I receive. So how does it work? How does this apply to training? Well, every single repetition you do in every single set, in every single training session, in every single training plan, you need to be aware of the yin-yang, right? The effort and the surrender. Every rep you do at the moment after that rep is yin, it's receptivity, it's recovery, it's awareness, right? And so, you know, you do that rep or that set, let's say you're doing a set of bench press, and you're doing like you're descending to a one rep max. After every set, right, you are going internally, you're breathing for recovery, back to nostril, slow nostril breathing, you know, exhaling slower than the inhale. You're developing that proprioceptive awareness of, you know, how the body's doing, you know, where is there any kind of anything out of alignment, right, that could put your next set at risk. And then, you know, you make adjustments if there is, right? Because I tell you what, I learned this very much the hard way early in my CrossFit days. No injuries in 20 years in the SEALs, and I finally get an injury doing CrossFit like everybody else in the world, right? So I don't blame myself. I blame CrossFit. but I was doing a 10 down to one ladder of bench press, deadlift, and power cleans. And it's called three bars of death, right? And you do this as fast as you can. And it's a hell of a fun workout. But I got it on about the like number seven down to one. I got an image flash in my head of me falling on the ground with a back injury. And right then, right, I should have just scaled back and be like, okay, something's going on. But I didn't, because there were other people around, and you know, this is a while ago, and I got caught up in it. It's like 2006. And sure enough, on the very last set, last rep, bang, you know, pulled a muscle in my lower back and down I go. And I learned that lesson. I was like, okay, yeah, pay attention to those signals. Sometimes it comes in like a flash, like that, like an image pops in your head that says, be careful, something's coming. Or you get an intuitive hit, right? That's your gut telling you. They know what's happening, right? They know what's coming. Those little bugs in your gut know what's coming, and they'll tell you, pay attention. That's the yin. But you can't pay attention to that if you don't train yourself to. And if you're always busy looking outward and putting energy in the, you know, into the universe, that you're going to get pushed back at you with that inertia. So that's one way to look at it. The other is to ensure that you take time after every training session in that yin period of recovery. And so for me, that's yoga asana, you know, or stretching for people who don't know what yoga asana is. It's going to be a daily hot cold treatment. I have a sauna, and I have a really cold pool that I jump into just for, you know, a couple minutes afterwards. I do a yoga practice 20 minutes every single morning with my wife. And that is very yin recovery, restorative, you know. In that case, it's before my workout, but so it's preparatory. I build in my training plan, complete days off, you know, but on those days off, I do, you know, yoga and I'll do, you know, like weighted walks and stuff like that. So it's not it's not like I'm not moving my body, but I'm taking it off from training. Stuff like that. And, you know, frankly, the other part is like, I'm aware that I am training for life. I'm not training to compete. I personally, speaking for me, I'm 6 years old. I don't need to put any more points on the board. I don't need to be anybody special, even though that was the poster. I was attracted to the SEALs. I became someone special. Now I'm trying to be nobody. And that's because the process of meditation over many, many years, just, you know, it's like rubbing the rough hewn edges off of the ego until the ego finally just looks at itself and says, what a laughing stock you were. Time for you to get out of the way. And so then, you know, you go into the phase of life where you're like, you don't need to be special or important or points on the board. Now, I'm not saying that it can't be motivating to go and train for a bodybuilding competition. It can be, and it's a great way to be inspired and have something to work for. But to make sure, my point is to make sure you're checking your ego at the door, to make sure that you're training for the right reasons. And for us, you know, in your 50s, 60s, 70s, 80s, 90s, hundreds, you're training for life, for optimal health and longevity. And so that your body is a fit vehicle for you to fulfill your mission on this planet.
Amen. Amen.
And so that's why I train, and I can't do that. I can't fulfill my mission if I'm injured all the time. And the only way that I can stay healthy is to make sure that, I, am balanced in my training. Right. And so I can bring it hard, right? At the same time, I don't need to all the time. Right. There's this thing called overtraining. And I used to overtrain in the early days with Seal Fit because I wanted to, you know, I had to lead by example, and I could bang out our 2.5-3 hour Seal Fit workouts and beat 95% of the 20-year-old SEAL candidates at 50 years old. But, you know, that took a toll on my body. Fortunately, I didn't get seriously injured at all, but I recognized that my sleep was, you know, disrupted from too much cortisol. And, you know, it was overtraining for my stage of life. And so I made some serious adjustments to my training. And that was kind of the yin principle again, put into practice. Is like, you got to look at yourself periodically and say, is what I'm doing still making sense? Have the goals I've chosen, are they still appropriate for me? Or is it time to kind of change my goals or change my training plan or find something else to do? Because variety is a spice of life, and you can easily get into a rut that leads to an injury by doing the same things over and over again. I saw that both in traditional, you know, American yoga, like Ashtanga yoga. Man, that greases a groove into you that leads to an injury real quick. And I saw it with CrossFit. So you need variety. You need tons of recovery time. You need to be building breathing and meditation and visualization into your training before and after training sessions. Lots and lots of recovery, you know, using traditional stretching, asana, and hydration. Taking chunks of time off where you really don't, just do something different, completely different. You know what I mean? And that can come in the form of like an active vacation, you know, you're biking across Europe or, you know, hiking in the Appalachians, but you're not under a barbell. We found that people make more progress when they take chunks of time off and they don't touch the barbell, or they don't touch whatever it is that they're doing. And then they come back and their whole orientation to training somehow shifts and has become elevated, and they start hitting some PRs.
I decided to do this competition because I wanted to get in the best shape that I'd ever been in. And I figured having a competition would force me to train toward that goal. And I've been making really great progress. And unfortunately, part of the method of training that we're doing, my training sessions are not very long. They're under an hour of weights and, for a while, very little cardio and no cardio. Now we're starting to raise the cardio again for the cut, but it's not about 2-3 hour workouts every day. But still, pushing beyond failure definitely can cause injury. And that was that's what's happened to me. And I'm working with my coach on this, and I'm working with a chiropractor who's worked with a lot of high-level athletes. Fingers crossed, we'll get through this, but damn, it's not been fun. I'm not going to lie. It's not been fun at all.
Yeah.
Not been fun at all.
Well, yeah, if it's not fun, but as long as it's growthful, then it's worth it.
You know what? I think everything happens for me and not to me. That's my belief.
That's right.
So it's a good one. So Mark, what had you go from my path is to be a warrior to, okay, I'm going back to commerce, because that's an interesting circle back.
Yeah, it's a great question. You know, when I was sitting on that meditation bench and I got that notion or that epiphany, that insight that I was to be a warrior, it, you know, the insight didn't come and say, Mark, you're meant to be a Navy SEAL. It was a warrior. And so that is an archetype, right? So that was a very important moment because I realized that, that your calling in life is more of an archetypal energy. It's not a doing, it's not, you know, a job or a career. Had I articulated my calling as to be a Navy SEAL Admiral, I would be a Navy SEAL Admiral and I would not have developed, you know, my programs and written books and I wouldn't be running my podcast and all that kind of stuff. I'd be on a different track and it would be a job, right? And I'd probably be miserable. So I wasn't really suitable for that bureaucratic structure. It's very difficult to grow beyond the structures that you align with in your life. That's why as an entrepreneur, be careful. Like when you build a company, you become a slave to the structure. And so you want to build a company that's very, very highly evolved construct, like, you know, integral level, highly evolved. So you don't trap yourself in a structure that you can't grow beyond. Well, I felt that very clearly. It, as a SEAL, like I absolutely loved the early years operating on a small team, you know, leading a small team, being part of that elite Navy SEAL kind of energy, door kicking energy, phenomenal. Like there's nothing like it in the world. But about, you know, 7, 8 years, 9 years into it as an officer, right, you kind of get shuttled out of that. And, you know, you're on track to be a bureaucrat, essentially. You know, running a SEAL team is like running a business, except, you know, you don't have to worry about making money. You're just worried about, you know, making sure your team is ready for combat, but you're not kicking down doors. You know, you're worried more about procurement and making sure you got the right gear and the training and the resources and all that kind of moving obstacles, just like a business leader. So that was part of it. And the other part was, I had gotten married and I really don't think my wife nor I really understood fully the impact of being a SEAL operator would have on a marriage. Like it's brutal. She's gone all the time, 11 months out of the year. And there's a lot of fear from the spouse about whether I'm going to return or even when, right? And so that creates a lot of uncertainty. And so we lasted a year and she came to me and just said, I don't think I can do this, right? It's either me or the Navy. So I chose her. But I wanted to, I was going to stay in the reserves and I asked her if that was okay. And she was fine with that. And so I actually got out after ultimately with, you know, getting mobilized to go to Iraq and a couple other things. I did 10 years of active duty and the rest was as a reserve officer. So the two reasons I transitioned off active duty, the marriage. And secondly, I was finding that it was very constrictive. The bureaucratic environment, you know, the stage of development of the military, I call second plateau, it's really the protector idea. And I was well beyond that in terms of my stage of consciousness development. Right. And so it was very hard. I was like, I had to like tuck myself into that role and that organizational structure. So I needed to get out to be free and I needed to get out to save my marriage. But I stayed in the reserves, which, you know, gave me a lot of freedom. It's the best job in the world is to be a SEAL reservist because I'm wearing a suit one day or whatever I'm wearing to start my business, to be part of my business. And then, you know, I've got to do like 45 to 60 days a year so I can go in on the, you know, 1 week in a month and go shooting or jumping or diving and get paid for it. And then if they need me on a special project, you know, then I put the uniform on, I go do the special project. And when I'm done, I take the uniform off. And I go back to being an entrepreneur. So that I really enjoyed that. It was great. And when I went back into the business world, though, I did look at that. I said, you know what? I don't want to go back into big business like with Coopers and Librand before the SEALs. Mm-hmm. I've kind of done with a big thing, right? Coopers is huge. Obviously, the U.S. Navy was huge. And SEALs are very entrepreneurial just by the virtue of their training and the type of people attracted to the SEALs. They're very, you know, a very creative, renegade-ish almost.
Yeah.
You have to be a Navy SEAL. You just don't make it through training. And you got to be a great teammate, meaning you got to be someone who can check their ego at the door and really, you know, build a team and take care of a team. And entrepreneurs need that as well, because, you know, I don't know any entrepreneur who does it alone, right? All great businesses are a team. So I decided that was kind of the path for me. And so I got out and I launched my first business. Was not SealFit. It was actually the Coronado Brewing Company. It was a little misaligned, but I just thought, you know, back then I was still drinking a lot of beer, and I thought having free beer for life, you know, because I owned the bar or the brewery would be a good idea. And it was fun for a while until my partners really showed their true colors. And then I got out of that, and then I launched SealFit.
Yeah. Wow. So, you know, there's a lot that you've shared, but there's a couple things that you shared that I really, really struck a chord with me. One was when you said it's very difficult to grow beyond the structures you align yourself with in life. And I instantly got the truth of that. Hmm. And a lot of my decisions started to make sense to me. There were structures I just didn't want to be a part of, but I hadn't vocalized that even to myself. I instinctively knew this was wrong for me, but I hadn't sat down and thought it out and written it out for myself. So thank you for that. I think that's a very powerful statement. And then when you said that SEALs are very entrepreneurial and they're also great teammates, and entrepreneurs are very entrepreneurial and they also need to be great teammates. So in that respect, they're very much like SEALs. And I'd never heard it put that way before by anybody, but it makes sense to me, because if you're an entrepreneur, you need to be a little bit of a renegade. You need to be ready to go out and do something that hasn't been done before with a whole bunch of naysayers and say, screw you, I'm going to do it anyways, right?
Right.
And you need
to be hell and high water, right?
From hell and high water, it's happening. And you need to be the kind of person who can enroll other people in your vision so they can go, oh yeah, man, this dude is the shit. Yeah, I want to go with him. I want to be part of what he's doing. Because if you can't do that, no one's going to follow you. And I would imagine if you're a leader in the SEALs, you need to be able to enroll the people that are part of your team on your mission, whatever the heck your mission happens to be. They got to be all in. They got to believe in you and believe in what you're doing to an extent where without it, it's impossible to be successful. Because everything that I've read about the SEALs and listened to from, you know, other prominent SEALs is that this is like going up against absolutely impossible odds every time and winning. It's crazy. If you were this good, if you were as good at being a gambler as you are at being a SEAL, you'd be the richest gambler in history, right?
That's right. That's a great analogy.
Yeah.
Yeah, there is. And it's all part and parcel of the training, right? So you don't get through SEAL training unless you are a great teammate. I mean, they call it SEAL teams, not SEAL individuals. And I think a big part of what the BUDS instructors are looking for is your capacity to be a great teammate. And frankly, they know that you are going to be their teammate, right? Because BUDS instructors, it's a temporary position. Then they're back on a team, and they know that the folks that they put through training, the ones who make it, could be, you know, the guy who's got their back on a future mission. And so that's kind of the hidden secret of SEAL training is, yeah, you got to be tough physically and mentally. You got to be prepared. You know, you got to be able to run, swim, and do countless push-ups and pull-ups. But none of that matters if you're all about yourself. This is why some of the first people to quit are like the, you know, the elite quarterback of the, you know, Harvard football team, where everything came easy to them and people were kissing their ass all the time, right? They don't make it. Whereas the gritty farm boy from Minnesota sails through, right? Because he's just all about, you know, big heart, you know, and hard work is fun and, you know, it's not about him. So yeah, that's really important, I think, for all leaders. Like, you know, I wrote a book called Staring Down the Wolf. It's basically about this. It's like leaders got to get out of their own way, because leaders are often the limiting force on their own team, because they bring their perfectionism and the expectation that they're supposed to have all the right answers or be the guy in charge or the girl, you know, have to prove themselves all the time, when the reality is what they really need to do is just support their team, remove obstacles, and energetically allow their team to thrive. Create the space and the environment, the culture for their team to absolutely thrive. We call that the 20X principle. So your team is capable of 20 times more than the sum total of the individuals, right? Because if you imagine a team like the SEALs that train together, that, you know, bleed together. We say the more you sweat in peace, the less you bleed in war. That has each other's back, that truly cares about each other to the point where they're checking each other's gear. They're making sure their training is on spot. They're not going to get injured because it's all about the team and the mission. Your success equals my success. That's an extraordinary approach to leading that that really then puts the onus of leadership on the team. And we say the team is the new leader. And wow. The team will come up with better solutions when given that kind of support than any individual leader ever could.
You know, I really like this 20X principle. My understanding of it in the past was you probably can do 20 times more than you think you can. I didn't realize that was within the context of a team, but it makes sense, right? It makes sense. Right. If you're within a team, if you have my back and I have your back and I'm checking to make sure your gear's okay and, you know, no one's going to shoot you in your blind spot when you're going around a corner, that makes it more likely that the mission's going to succeed than if I just say, okay, you go do your thing, I'm going to go do my thing, right?
Right. If you're on a team with 14 or 15 people, you got, let's say it's 15, you got 14 people watching your back. You got 14 people rooting for your success, right?
That's amazing.
So
that's absolutely amazing.
Magnifies or it's exponential in terms of your potential.
That's incredible. That's absolutely incredible. So Mark, earlier on, you mentioned that one of the things that you had started to focus on in recent times was leadership development. And you feel that right now, just given what's going on in the world and in the world of business with AI and so forth, it's more important than ever to focus on that. Can you elaborate on that?
Sure. I drew the distinction between horizontal development and vertical development. In the past, what we've done is horizontal development for leadership and even, you know, general academic. And that is basically you are who you are, go get some skills and, you know, get a certificate or go to this degree program and you're going to pack some knowledge in and it's going to give you some strategy and tactics, but it doesn't change who you are. We know this from life. What changes us are the serious setbacks, right? The times you get just slammed to the ground or kicked in the balls, kicked in the Jimmy, if you want to cut that one out.
Yeah, it's all good. Kicked in the balls is good.
And then we, you know, you grow or you don't. Right. And so, what I found is through this process of meditation and even integrating meditation into movement practices and into my life with this idea of sthira-sukha, yin-yang, and having really robust daily practices that you can unlock vertical development. So vertical development, in contrast to horizontal development, is the type of development that is similar to what happens when you get smacked down, but without the smackdown. And so this is really the domain of kind of like Eastern Buddhist psychology or deep yoga meditation practice, where you are developing your consciousness, developing your mind, developing your awareness, expanding your sense of self, opening your heart, deepening your compassion. Those are all different ways of looking at the outcomes and the / benefits of vertical development. And so from my perspective, because things are changing so fast and AI is really kind of the leading culprit here, like AI, and then obviously all the technologies that enable that to become, you know, front and center, as well as in the seams of everything we do in our life. And also media and technology in general, you know, it's giving the impression that everything's moving so like faster and faster. We call that exponential growth, exponential technology. The human brain, human mind developed in the horizontal method with just, you know, adding more tools and skills doesn't have the capacity to navigate that very well. That's why we keep seeing the term VUCA show up now. The VUCA, volatility, uncertainty, complexity, ambiguity, is a term the military has been using for 30, 40 years to denote what used to be episodic events like a combat or a terrorist incident. Now it's like every day. And, you know, the battlefield is always VUCA now. Well, guess what? The business battlefield is VUCA now. And so leaders need to do different things so they get different results instead of doing the same things and expecting different results. And one of the different things they can do is vertically develop themselves. And one of the main ways to do that is through a very well thought out practice of meditation and integration and getting back into the idea of a whole mind, where you're using much more of your mental skills, mental capacity. Basically, you're opening up the aperture. So there's more information is able to flow through and flow be understood from within you, from the heart mind and the gut mind. So this type of practice that I call Unbeatable Mind, which is part of the training that I developed for the SEALs, really does a multidimensional job at opening up, you know, what you would think of as your mind, right? You have a increasing capacity for direct perception. You have things like Michael Osterlink and I talk about, like transrational intuition, the ability to have that really integrative intuition, which is like the gut, heart, brain, you know, entire enteric peripheral nervous system. You're really being able to like bring them online to be able to perceive that information that those aspects of your brain / mind system have to share with you. Again, what this leads to is the ability to navigate the VUCA with a lot more awareness, calm, centeredness, clarity, creativity. What I call Wei Wu Wei, which is the action without the actor, you know, where your ego is set aside and you're allowing spontaneous action. And, or what the Japanese term Shibumi points to, effortless perfection. So,
wow.
Vertical development is what I, what I've been building with my Unbeatable Mind program. It's what I'm validating through my PhD dissertation. I didn't come up with that term. You know, there's others that are working in this field. It's relatively new though for leadership development, but that's why I said I think it's the next frontier. These are the skills that we all need.
Yeah, damn straight. So what does the acronym VUCA stand for again?
Volatility, uncertainty, complexity, and ambiguity.
Wow.
And it, you know, points to kind of the world that we're in, where things are moving faster and faster. You can't trust information. And you can't trust that you're not operating out of some bias or some, you know, manipulation, right? And so you got to like really, really breathe into what's going on now and just pause and learn how to be still and get the trusted information, which is coming from your heart and your gut, getting out of your head. You can't trust your head, right? Your brain has been conditioned. Your brain is packed with information which is false or flawed or incomplete. And so now as leaders, we have to be able to really open up and tap into our heart's intuition and our heart's insight, as well as our gut mind, which is telling us, you know, where the danger is and where the opportunities are. Has a big, you know, effect on our moods and our optimism, right? It's, you know, all of these parts or aspects of our brain, mind, body, mind need to be developed and brought online. Or else we're just going to get bowled over by whatever's coming.
You know, I was having a conversation. One of the things I do on a legacy basis is I've created and I run a men's organization. We actually have a men's podcast. I'd love to have you on that to talk about these issues as it relates to men and manhood and masculinity, if you're up for that.
Sure, of course.
So the fellow that I run the group with, he is he's a blue-collar business owner. He owns a landscape development and architecture company. So, you know, he and snow removal, he owns the company with his brother and he works in it. He's not what you'd call an intellectual, not at all. But we were having a call with a group of men that were training to become leaders so they can lead the next generation of men that come into our program. And he was talking today about how scientific research has shown that the same types of cells that are in the brain are in the heart and in the gut. So right. Actually, science is now proving what we've intuitively understood for centuries, that there's the ability to make decisions and process information outside of our brains. It's in our heart and it's in our gut. And when we ignore those centers and their incredible ability to make decisions, we make really, really bad decisions. That's if true. The brain overrules your gut, that is bad. We were telling this to one of the men whose brain was in the process of overruling his gut. And we said, no, you can't let that happen. That's a bad idea.
That's right. Yeah. The gut, that's why we call it the gut brain and the heart brain.
Yeah.
They have neuroprocessing capacity. The heart is profoundly important. They're both really important, right? The biome and the gut really will affect your moods. It'll affect a lot of your subconscious thinking, a lot of what we think of as intuitive, instinctual information will come from the gut and the biome. Like there's more genetic makeup in your gut than there is in the rest of your body. And those little bugs are partners, right? And they work through the enteric nervous system. And so the whole enteric nervous system really is part of your brain, you know. You can't look at your brain, it's just what's in your head. But, you know, Western science is like loves to name everything and particularize everything down to, you know, this or that. It's not a this or that. You have a brain system. Your body is a mind. The mind is the body.
Yeah.
And the mind is the output or the perception, right, that you have based upon the you know, sensory information you're getting from the nervous system and, you know, then processed in your cranial housing unit, which we typically call the brain. So the practice of various practices of meditation reintegrate all that and bring, you know, bring those other centers back online, or that bring them online in terms of your ability to perceive and receive and make sense of the information.
This is fascinating. Mark, I could speak to you for another 3 hours about these topics. Yeah, it really has been super, super califragilistic. And I really like this VUCA concept. And I think this is something that I would like to learn about more and understand how it applies to the world outside of the military context and the world of business today. Because what you were talking about, not being able to trust information and not even being able to trust that you're not coming from your own biases is super true. You know, mm-hmm. I'm originally an immigrant from the Middle East. I'm a Christian from Iran, and I grew up during the Islamic Revolution. I was 11 years old in 1978 when the Islamic Revolution started and Khomeini came back to Iran in the late 78, 79. And we could not trust anything coming from the official organs under the control of the Islamic authorities. We just couldn't. We knew it was all lies. Yeah. And when we came here, it was a bit of an adjustment to go, oh my God, the news is actually mostly telling the truth. That's pretty cool.
I know. And you've seen that getting chipped away recently.
Exactly. And that's what I was about to say. You know, it has been getting chipped away, and you know, it's like deja vu all over again for me, because I noticed this when I was a kid, and I'm thinking to myself, you know, we got to make sure that this doesn't become the new normal, the new narrative of the United States and Canada and the other countries in the Western world, because if we lose freedom in America, there's nowhere for people like me or you to run to. There's nowhere else. This is it. We're going to enter 1,000 years of darkness, and we can't have that. So why I think your work is so important is because not only is it something that people in business can use in order to make you know, better decisions, be better people, live from a more calm and centered place. But I think the average person out there in the world today can use this to fortify themselves and protect themselves from disinformation, mm-hmm. and even from buying into biases that may have been planted there. You know, you talked about how when you were a young man, you came to the realization, to the epiphany, that the path you'd chosen was not a path you'd really chosen. It had been planted in you. Mm-hmm. I think there's a lot of people that are waking up to the fact that some of the beliefs that they've chosen are not really their beliefs, and they've been planted in them.
That's and right. This is a very your powerful mind, thing. If you're not training your mind, someone's training it for you. And the results will speak for themselves.
Amen.
The best way to train your mind is to literally draw a circle around yourself and sit in it and just sit there and let yes and no chase each other around the circumference. Don't do anything wow. about it. Just watch. Just watch, 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 watch until the truth is revealed to you. The heart will always reveal the truth. The brain is easily deceived.
You know, I'd love to introduce, I work with my lady, and she's someone with a background in the mind, and she ran a psychology clinic for 13 years, and she's got a master's in psychology. She's done a lot of studying on this. I think she'd be fascinated by this conversation, and she'd love to speak to you. I've been nudging her to get her own podcast going. We've been talking about it for a year and a half. One of these days, it's going to happen.
God bless you. Do it together.
Oh my God. I bring her on my show and sometimes that works, but hey, that's a cool idea. It's a cool idea, but I think she'd love you and love everything that you're talking about and thinking about, because this is powerful, important stuff. The world needs Mark Divine and what he does out there, because we're living in a time of VUCA in business, in the cultural milieu of the West, and people need to understand how they can defend themselves against nasty narratives. There's no other way to put it, nasty narrative. So Mark, where do you want us to send people to interact with you and your organization and the great material and content that you put out?
Yeah, I appreciate that. Well, if anyone wants to read my book, Unbeatable Mind is a good place to start. Find it at Amazon. Yeah. My Mark Divine Show podcast, available wherever you listen to podcasts. So that's a good place to hear me do the interviewing. But I like to, I like to share my philosophy through the interviews. And I enjoyed your interview style. It was awesome.
Thank you.
Our business is going through a little bit of a transition, but currently unbeatablemind.com website would have some great information on kind of our introductory courses. We have a 30-day course. We have something called the foundation course. We even have a coach certification, which is virtualized since 2020. So we have about 400 and some odd certified coaches. And if that's something that interests people, then you can reach out. Look at the information on the unbeatablemind.com website, or reach out to us at info@unbeatablemind.com.
I'll make sure all that gets put in the show notes by the team when they put this out. So Mark, we end off every episode by asking you as our guest expert for what we call your top three expert action steps. These are your three best pieces of advice in bullet point style to help our listener take their life, their business, their mind to the next level. What say you?
Nakamura once told us, one day, one lifetime. What I took that to mean is every day is your best opportunity. It's the only one you have, and it may be your last, and you have a lifetime of learning to experience in this day. So pay attention.
I like it.
Number two is how you start your day will dictate how the day goes. So first, win in your mind before you step foot in the battlefield. You do that through a powerful morning ritual. And number three, it all comes back to the breath. You want to be in the center with that circle around you while yes and no chase their tails. You come back to the breath. Slow, controlled nostril breathing. Hold it on the inhale and the exhale. And practice that every day. Five count in, five count hold, five count out, five count hold. Three breaths per minute. That'll develop an intensely calm, clear, and collected kind of posture in your mind, which then is the platform to begin meditation from.
These are three excellent expert action steps, man. Fantastic. Thank you so much. Thanks for taking the time to come on the show. I really enjoyed the conversation. God bless you, brother.
Likewise. I appreciate you very much. Thank you. Hooyah.
Hooyah. And that wraps up another exciting episode of the podcast, The Thought Leader Revolution. To find out more about today's incredible guest, the one and only Mark Divine, go to unbeatablemind.com or go to the show notes wherever you happen to listen to this episode, either at the website, iTunes, Spotify, Google Play, Audible, what have you. Get all the information about how to get his book, how to look into the courses that he offers, and really just dive deeply into learning about what Mark has to share, because what he has to share really is all about introducing you to yourself, maybe even for the first time, and doing it from a really calm space. I got to tell you, I'm excited to go back and reread some of the books I bought way back when that you wrote, and I'm going to check out some of the courses that you do as well, and I encourage you listening to do the same. Until next time, goodbye.
This episode has been brought to you by eCircleAcademy.com, the proven system to add 6 to 7 figures a year to your thought leader practice.